Turns out, China's economic miracle maybe isn't going so well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. Wednesday today, I do believe the 9th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been a week thick with China news. We told you about the double-digit drop in exports the other day. Not great for an export-centric economy. This morning came news of deflation in the world's second biggest economy, falling prices across the board, which sounds great but isn't, for the effect it can have on consumers, influencing them to perhaps not buy things on the theory those things will be cheaper in a month or two. All of which is to say maybe things are not so great in the Middle Kingdom. That's kind of the through line of a new piece in Foreign Affairs by Adam Posen. He's the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Adam, welcome to the program. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Kai.
I will start with the title of this piece. It is called The End of China's Economic Miracle. I note for the record, there is no question mark on the end of that title. What are you seeing?
Well, there is legitimately still a question, but you're right. The title sticks at my head out there. What I see is a trend that had been already underway since start of Xi's term, roughly 2015, of greater and greater state intervention into the economy, that zero COVID policy as implemented in China made things feel very insecure for average Chinese people in their livelihoods, in their assets. It's very different than when they were clamping down on Ant or Alibaba, which is, you know, some big oligarchs. This is people's everyday lives.
You know, it's funny. You spend as much, maybe more time on the politics of the Chinese economy as you do the actual nuts and bolts. And one of the things you point out is that the Chinese people, because of the arbitrariness of what President Xi has done during zero COVID, they are just responding less to his stimuli, if you will, and they're doing whatever they feel they need to do to survive.
Yeah, and I think it's very important not so much to pretend I'm an expert on Chinese politics, which you kindly don't pretend, but to say that the political economy matters. And this is something that's not just airy. It's we've seen this in other governments with autocratic regimes, that if you can hold off being too interventionist, too political in people's lives, and the people know what I call the no politics, no problem deal. So protesting in Tiananmen Square or in Hong Kong will get you hammered. But your everyday life, if you're a non-political person, you can go, you can invest, you can spend. And the economics of this are a very clear prediction. One piece is what you said, which is that stimulus policies, whatever the economic policies of the government, to clean up the banking system, to put cash in people's pockets, are going to be less effective because people don't necessarily believe that they'll be maintained. The other piece is that it's not just savings have shot up, because overall savings haven't changed that much. It's that specifically people are abjuring things like durable goods purchases, investment in small business, stuff that ties up their assets. And they're preferring things that feel safer and more liquid, like bank accounts.
You know, just on that, I forget what you called it. No intervention, no problem, no...
No politics, no problem.
No politics, no problem, right? So the deal has been for 40 plus years now in China that the government will let you get, you know, rich, in air quotes, as long as you don't get political. Do you think that bargain is over now?
I think it is in people's minds. And they will try to reinstate it. I mean, we've already seen leaders from the Communist Party around Xi say, oh, no, we want a vibrant private sector in China. Oh, you big tech tycoons, you can be reassured. But it's hard to be credible once you get to that point. Once Xi has so visibly, forcibly crossed the Rubicon, and there's no signs that he regrets this, I don't think he can get it back.
One imagines this piece is being widely read in the halls of Congress and in the White House, and people are seeing, as you point out in this piece, that there may be some opportunity here for the United States. What do you imagine them to be?
My view is it's an opportunity for a rethink and a shift from the United States. So under the Trump administration, and a little more responsibly, honestly, but still under the Biden administration, there's been this very conflictual approach to China. And one part of it in the economic sphere has been excluding people from China, making students and workers feel unwelcome as potential spies, suspecting Chinese investors who are taking over American companies or buying American assets. And I think we want to go the opposite way. During the 30s, facing the fascist regimes, during the Cold War up till the mid-80s, it wasn't clear that we were necessarily outperforming them economically. It was clear that our property rights for individuals and safety of individuals' livelihoods was better. And I think we can use that in the new conflict between systemic rivalry between China and the U.S. to say, we welcome Chinese investment, we welcome Chinese people, we welcome Chinese ideas. And the more we emphasize exit, it's not going to be like the Berlin Wall, but the more Xi will put up barriers. And the more he puts up barriers, the more he induces people to exit. Yeah.
China has, as you say in this piece, it has now a case of economic long COVID, right? That what Xi Jinping did during the zero COVID is going to have lasting effects for, and these are your words, it's going to last for years. And I guess we have to point out, just by way of closing our discussion, that that's not good for the global economy.
It's not. Now, to be clear, I'm talking about a drag and more instability and less productivity growth, but not the collapse by any means of China. Yep. But I think the thing to say is it's not good for the world. It's not good for a large number of people in the U.S. who make money selling into China or make money from China assembling pieces of their equipment. It subtracts. Mm-hmm. And it's not as destabilizing as we might fear because China has itself become more closed in some ways in recent years, but it shouldn't be seen as a good thing for China to be economically weakening.
It's a piece in Foreign Affairs by Adam Posen. He's the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and the piece is called The End of China's Economic Miracle. Adam, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, let's take the global perspective here, shall we? The Shanghai Composite overnight our time, down about 0.5%. U.S. equities during the day here, a little down and then down some more. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While one gets ahead of the news at one's peril, I feel completely confident in saying that throughout the day tomorrow, news feeds and broadcasts will be full of the latest reading on the Consumer Price Index, and in particular, how much said consumer prices rose compared to this time last year. That particular number, inflation year on year, is a big deal in the world of economic data. But in the economy of right now, that number can also be a little bit misleading, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
You can think of the year-to-year inflation number as a pretty simple math question. First, take how much prices rose last August. Then, add how much they rose in September, in October, and November, and every month until this past July. In other words,
a year-on-year indicator is reflective of inflation over the past year.
That's Laura Veldkamp, an economics professor at Columbia. She says that number can be useful if you want to filter out temporary changes in inflation that happen month to month.
Some things are on sale and some things had a little temporarily daily spike on the day we measured them. So to smooth out some of that noise, we typically average.
But the problem with averaging up the last 12 months of inflation data is that the economy looked very different 12 months ago.
The more months you add, the smoother it gets, but also the more stale it gets.
That's Jason Furman, an economics professor at Harvard. He says inflation has been slowing down over the last several months, and so a number that looks at 12 months of inflation data isn't all that useful.
In an economy that's changing as quickly as it has been on the inflation side, I think that staleness is just not worth it.
There is a compromise between the year-on-year inflation data and the month-to-month figures.
My favorite is the quarter-on-quarter, which is something in between.
That's Menzi Chen, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin. He says looking at inflation in three-month chunks keeps the data fresh and free of any one-off distractions, like a spike in broccoli prices.
If it's truly a one-off event, then that's going to dissipate the next month.
And that, Chin says, can give him a better idea of where inflation is headed. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report will give you a better idea of where everything in this economy is headed 5 days a week, early, early, early. Check it out. Congress gets back into session, which isn't going to be until after Labor Day. The daily legislative calendars in both chambers are going to be packed, mostly with how to reconcile their different spending bills, which ideally gets done by the end of September, and we are spared yet another government shutdown. But the reality is, despite the intensity and the rancor of this fight every single year, the actual chunk of federal spending being set by what's called the appropriations process is relatively small, and as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington, getting smaller.
Of the more than $6 trillion the federal government spends in a given year, there are two types, mandatory and discretionary. And that discretionary spending...
Oh, it's probably roughly in the neighborhood of a third, which a bit more than half is defense.
David Reich is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
And a little bit less than half is everything else, which we call non-defense.
So what Congress is fighting over now is just one half of that one third of the federal budget, non-defense discretionary spending, including a lot of what we think of the government doing.
It's the National Weather Service. It's the air traffic control system. It's the IRS. It's the federal courts.
And all of these things are supposed to be included in 12 separate appropriations bills in each chamber, which come from...
the 12 different appropriations committees, both House and Senate, they're the same committees with the same jurisdictions, deciding how to spend our discretionary spending.
That's Laura Blessing, a senior fellow at Georgetown's Government Affairs Institute. I guess you can kind of think of the appropriations process like, I don't know, an orchestra. Congressional leadership is the conductor, and the various appropriations committees are the different sections of the orchestra. Strings, brass, woodwinds, percussion. Just imagine there are 12 sections, not four. Anyhow, ideally, they all work together to produce beautiful music. 12 spending bills passed by the September 30th deadline. But...
the formal federal appropriations process is broken. We have really diverged from both the timelines and the process and so many different aspects.
Blessing says Congress hasn't followed procedure to pass the 12 bills in the prescribed fashion in over a decade, much less get them done on time.
We have seen continuing resolutions, or CRs, used to be seen as a sign of failure. Now they're now seen as a sign of success, which is extraordinarily telling.
And adding to the intensity of this dysfunction, the portion of the budget being controlled by this process is shrinking. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The discretionary portion of the budget has been being squeezed over time due to the aging of the population and high healthcare costs. So Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, they are all growing faster than the overall economy and the overall budget, and they're putting pressure on the other areas.
Politicians don't want to touch those popular programs, are often hesitant to limit the growth of defense spending. And then, of course, there's that other chunk of mandatory spending, interest on the national debt.
Right now, we spend more on interest payments than we do at the federal level for all spending on children, anyone under 18. That means we are spending more to finance the borrowing of the past than investing in the next generation in the future.
McGinnis says fiscal responsibility is important when it comes to the annual spending bills, but...
and perhaps politicians have something to still learn on the topic because they spend all their energy on really the smallest slices of the budget.
But it seems like the easiest slice for lawmakers to take a bite out of. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was a lot simpler back then.
Oh, yes, it was. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On this Wednesday, the Dow Industrial is down 191. That's about 0.5%, 35,123. The NASDAQ dropped 162 points. That is 1.1%, 13,722. The S&P 500 declined 31 points, about 0.7%, 44.67. Investors unplugged from the tech sector today. Chipmaker NVIDIA decreased 4.7% the day after announcing a new chip in the AI sphere. Facebook owner Meta unfriended 2.3%. Apple peeled off about 0.8% today. Bond prices rose. When that happens, the yields go the other way. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 4.01%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is, as we've talked about on the program, a very real housing affordability problem in this country. There is also an office vacancy problem in this country. See also people still working from home. So it kind of stands to reason that there's a lot of talk right now about turning some of those vacant offices into apartments. A new working paper out this month from the National Bureau of Economic Research says somewhere between 10 and 15% of the office buildings in the United States might be suitable for conversion. There would be more affordable housing, more people in downtowns, and lower carbon emissions. There would also be costs, a lot of costs, as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
One question the authors of this paper wanted to answer, does converting offices to affordable apartments make financial sense for developers? Arpit Gupta is an associate professor of finance at the NYU Stern School of Business and a co-author of the study. He says they came up with a model to determine this based around the deteriorating value of vacant office buildings.
If the building value does in fact deteriorate as much as we think it has in many cities, then the conversion can pencil out.
But the margins are tight, so Gupta says subsidies would help. Cities are already losing tax revenue on vacant office buildings, says Jeffrey Havsey, a specialist in commercial real estate at Moody's Analytics.
Because there are fewer and fewer or no tenants in there, the tax receipts for that local municipality continue to decline.
So if a state or local government offers tax relief to a developer in order to turn a building into apartments, bringing people into the area,
that geographic location becomes a better or more vibrant economic area, and that overall can raise the tax revenue for the municipality.
Incentive programs are already happening in places like Chicago, Washington, D.C., and California, and there's a push on Capitol Hill for federal tax breaks for apartment conversions. Achilles Suarez is a lobbyist for NIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association.
If you spur conversions by a little bit of help from the federal government, you can make a big difference in a lot of communities.
Suarez is pitching members of Congress on a 20% tax credit for developers' conversion costs. He says legislation to do that could be introduced in the fall. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Speaking of office space and how it gets used or not, pour one out for WeWork. Once a mighty and seemingly unstoppable co-working company, it's continued its downward spiral and has warned investors it is getting closer to bankruptcy, all of which does make one wonder, did the pandemic squash the whole co-working industry in its path? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Sam Rosen remembers the good old days, that's a decade or so ago, when he opened up a co-working space in Chicago.
It was a lot simpler back then. It was pretty easy to fill up and build our first space up successfully.
Today, Rosen is the CEO of DeskPass, a platform that connects companies and co-working spaces in nearly 200 cities. He says his client base has tripled since before the pandemic, but their needs have changed. They'll rent by the day or hour for meetings with specific teams or clients.
So instead of spending money for an office that's only used 20% of the time, only paying for space when they use it.
Rosen says co-working spaces have changed too. They're opening in suburbs instead of central business districts, and they're being built into mixed-use facilities at gyms and social clubs.
They're in a partnership with the landlord or the owner, where they both share in the risk and they both share in the upside.
That's not how co-working spaces have traditionally operated, says analyst Dylan Brzezinski at Green Street. WeWork, for instance, took on long-term leases.
And it suffered by not being able to achieve high occupancies when they went out to lease that to tenants.
Brzezinski says it's hard to know exactly how co-working spaces are faring. Most are privately owned. But it's no secret that office landlords in general are having a tough time. Callie Williams-Yost is a flexible work consultant.
We are coming out of what was a crisis-driven execution of flexibility. And we are still reimagining how, when, and where we are going to work.
When it comes to the office, we still haven't settled into the new normal. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
So let's pick up where we left off with Adam Posen at the top of the program, his analysis of the short and medium term future of the Chinese economy. To that, we will now add some on the ground reality, what small and medium sized Chinese companies are saying about the actual state of play over there. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has that from Shanghai.
I'm at a tea shop in an affluent area in Shanghai's Pudong district. The boss, Jane Vajung, prepares a type of oolong tea, Tie Guanyin, for us. The tea is of such good quality, she says. You just need to steep the tea leaves for 8 seconds and then drink. That's when I ask. How's business? And she asks if I want the truth. After the pandemic, many clients who were big spenders have already run away. Run away meaning emigrated. A lot of people have been talking about leaving after Shanghai's strict lockdown last year. So I lost a lot of my big customers, and the rest of my clients don't spend as often. Like, if they used to buy our tea once a month, now it's once every 3 months. Meantime, Shanghai's government increased the amount employers pay into the social security system. Again, by our count, a lot of small and medium-sized businesses have paid an extra 16% a year every year since the pandemic in 2020. Again, Jane Vajang.
For a shop of our size, that means I have to make an extra $14,000 in sales revenue to cover the additional costs this year.
High labor costs might make it even harder for new graduates to enter the workforce. At a Starbucks, Wu Yo tells me he was interning at a freight forwarding company doing sales for the past year.
My salary was $560 per month plus commission.
And because he was an intern, he says, the company didn't need to provide social welfare benefits.
The company is very bad. I graduated this June. If I'd kept working there, the company would have had to pay my social insurance premiums. Instead, they asked me to leave because my sales performance wasn't good enough. And then they hired another round of interns, so they don't need to give social welfare benefits.
At the same time, Wu Yo says he knows employers are asked to pay a lot into China's social welfare system. It's at least 37% of a worker's salary. Wu Yo says he's part of the unluckiest graduating class in recent Chinese history.
If I graduated a year or two earlier in the middle of the pandemic, I could have earned more money. Because when everything was shut down abroad, China's factories were still operating. So we had a lot of exports.
And he thinks under better economic conditions, his former company would have kept him on. Back at the tea shop, Jane Vajung says two of her staff quit recently, but she's not in a huge hurry to replace them.
The reason I could survive this pandemic is because I got a business loan using my condo as collateral. I have to thank the government for providing the loan for small business owners. But for those who don't have property, they went out of business.
Her goal for the next 3 years, she says, is to just survive. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, sorry, it's one more China thing, but like I said, it has been a week. President Biden signed an executive order this afternoon limiting outbound U.S. investment by venture capitalists and private equity firms in key Chinese industries, most of them in high tech and or with potential military applications. Think semiconductors, quantum computers, artificial intelligence, those kinds of things. The Treasury Department is stressing the rules will be, quote, narrowly targeted. But I can tell you because I was there, they were a hot topic of conversation during meetings on that trip that Secretary Yellen took to Beijing last month. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I saw this on Bloomberg that new swimming pool construction in this country is down as much as 30%. Inflation and high interest rates are putting them out of reach. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostat, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.